Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about director Quentin Tarantino, one of the bad boys of Hollywood. A very smart person, by the way. I understand he's got an IQ of something like 160. Inauspicious beginnings, though, you know, came up, you know, living in California. His parents were an actor and a musician and a nurse from Tennessee. And he bursts on the scene with Reservoir Dogs in 1992. But before we get too far into that, Mike, two questions for you. One, have you ever met Quentin Tarantino? And if so, do you have a Quentin Tarantino story? And do you have anything to add to that very sparse background I just provided?
The short answer is no, I've never met him, though I feel like I do know him in the sense of not only that he has such a strong identity as a screenwriter and director, but of course also plays small roles in some of his own pictures. And so we all feel like we have an image of him, and he's such a media celebrity. But again, the short answer is I've never met him. But I would want to elaborate a little bit on the family background. He never actually met his real father. The guy just disappeared. And then in later years, when he was identified, they didn't particularly want to meet him. You know, so there was this enormous gap between the biological father and the son. And he was the result of a marriage in teen years. In fact, Quentin and his mother moved to California when she was only 16, I think, and had already had him. So again, like mid-teens, you know, she's giving birth and the father disappears and so on. When you mention his high IQ, I agree. He's like whip smart. And he's probably one of the smartest high school dropouts you'll ever meet. And that can happen. He's an independent learner. That's the polite way to put it, right? He doesn't work well within structure or stricture. So for Marie and myself, you know, as academics, it's a little awkward to talk about this in a sort of recommendation-worthy way. Like, yeah, he's great. You should do what he did. No, because he dropped out of school, and we're not about that at Howard Community College. And so there's that kind of weirdness of talking about someone who's done remarkable things in film. And yet, when you look at the personal background, it is, you know, a rough upbringing. It was initially, and certainly in terms of academic training, it's just not there, really. I do also want to add something in terms of what would be his stepfather, a musician and you know, slash actor, if you will, that he was close to. His stepfather was the real movie buff. That's the movie education. What I find amusing there, it always makes me smile, is his stepfather, sort of like Quentin in a way, did not have a censor mechanism. His stepfather introduced him to all kinds of movies. And this is the terrific thing, all kinds of movies, and including the fact, and I did a double take when I was reading about this again, when Quentin was only 4 or 5 years old, his stepfather was showing him movies like Carnal Knowledge. Now, if that's not a red flag, I don't know what is. You can see the formation of his taste, if you will, also kind of alarming in some ways. And so the essential point here is that it's really cinematically a self-education or with a boost from the stepfather. The really significant thing, and this is something that has achieved almost mythic proportions, is that as Quentin gets into his later teens, he goes to work for a video store in Southern California. This is a great zeitgeist moment. This is the point where we have to remind ourselves that once upon a time, and that's sort of riffing on a Tarantino title, but once upon a time, it was really difficult sometimes to see all the movies you wanted to see. You might find it on late night television or you know, you might somehow have a local film series, but some films were either not available or difficult to access. I mean, I can remember growing up, there were films I read about that I didn't have a chance to see for whatever reason for a while. He is blessed to be a part of an MTV or post-MTV generation in the sense of how much is available just by turning on the TV, or in his case, you know, you have a video store and then of course some videos and DVDs and so on. And we won't even talk about streaming nowadays, but the fact that virtually the world, the cinematic world is there for the viewing. He's part of that first wave of young filmmakers who really benefit from that. If he wants to watch some old Hollywood movie, he can do it. And in reading about this period, which he's often asked about, so there are a lot of quotes to this effect, he explained it once this way. I needed a job, and that was the coolest thing I could think of. Now, when I think about that quote, I've had some friends and acquaintances who are about the same age. Quentin's 58 now, but people in roughly the same generation as Quentin. And they had similar jobs as video store clerks. And you know what? Those are some of the smartest and most opinionated people you ever meet in your life. I had a local video store I used to go to, And they knew every arcane filmmaker, every bit of esoterica. And if they thought something was garbage, they would tell you, even though it's their job to like sell it to you, right? They would tell you, that's really bad. How about something on this shelf over here? They curated the collections, in other words. They weren't just there as, you know, minimum wage employees, if you will, just, you know, work in the register. No, they really cared about it. And they were not shy about giving opinions. And so for Quentin, that was his film school education as much as anything, working there. And you know what? When you watch his movies, he's so cine literate. You get so many references, so many things you can relate to. And, you know, sometimes they're really heavily underscored and you can't miss it. Other times it's just, you know, his skill set where he just has acquired all this knowledge. And in terms of his taste, I don't want to use the word garbage right now. I'll use an expression I've used in writing about him, which is that he has A-level filmmaking skills, again, primarily self-taught. And he loves to apply those A-level filmmaking skills to B-level material, or what traditionally would have been considered B-level material. And it's a great kind of matchup. Some would say mismatch, but it's a great combination of elements. So those are some of the things that really helped to take us, I think, into what would become a career that's fully launched, really, when he makes his very first film, Reservoir Dogs. Let me hand it back to you. And then I do have a lot to say about Reservoir Dogs, but I've been talking a lot. Back to you.
I am so stealing that word, cine literate. That is a fabulous word. All right. There's a couple little other fun facts to know and tell about young Quentin Tarantino. First of all, he was named for a character on Gunsmoke, which you sort of have to love. He got his first job in the film industry at age 16 by lying about his age as an usher at the Pussycat Theater, a porn theater in Torrance, California. So, I mean, again, Mike, that's one of those things where if this was a Saturday Night Live skit, there'd be that person who would in the background go, red flag. Another thing I want to mention is the summer after his 15th birthday, he was grounded by his mother for shoplifting Elmore Leonard's novel, The Switch, from Kmart, which is interesting because, you know, it's always fun to find out that other people are human and make mistakes when they're young. But, you know, he goes on later to actually do a Elmore Leonard film. So that just has to be a wonderful little bookmark there that, you know, got in all that trouble because I swiped your book. Later on, you know, they had to have met each other to work on that film. So I like that sort of bookending of incidents. And in 86, he gets his first Hollywood job working with Roger Avery as a production assistant on Dolph Lundgren's exercise video, Maximum Potential. And you kind of have to love that little detail too, because it's so random. And, you know, for people who are maybe not as old as you and I, Mike, Dolph Lundgren used to be this huge, big deal. So this would have been a coup. This would have been the time you would, you know, call your mom and say, I just got this job on Dolph Lundgren's exercise video, and everybody would have been excited. He also said, when people ask me if I went to film school, I tell them, no, I went to films. So what you said about him, you know, working in the video shop, you know, he just had to be surrounded by all of these options and, you know, just watching everything. So that actually comes into play with his career, because a lot of his films will reference other films, or he'll have characters in his movies talk about favorite films. And that just has to be, you know, him speaking from his own mind, the things that he cares about, he thinks that other people would talk about, but all very, very film oriented. So now let's dive into Reservoir Dogs, which I think is where he burst onto the scene. He made a huge impact at Cannes with this movie. And there's a million things to say about it, but I'm going to let you start.
In fact, I love to pontificate about Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, good. Let's go.
It's his first film, and it's still my favorite Quentin Tarantino film. I use it in a course I teach on Hollywood in the 1990s. And I really love it. And I'll tell you, to cut to the chase on this, one reason I love it so much is it has a really tight 100-minute running time. And I say really tight because that's relative to some of his other movies. My major reservation about his career, and for me it really is a major one, is a lot of his films, he doesn't make a lot of films, but his films tend to run long, don't they? More than 2.5 hours, pushing 3 hours. And some people take umbrage there because they're offended by the extreme language or extreme violence or both. And in my own case, in terms of personal taste, I don't so much take umbrage at that, because I watch a lot of movies and, you know, I can sit through all sorts of things and have. But for me, it isn't so much that he has that extremity there and with language and violence. It's more a matter of just the repetition, just the reinforcement oh my goodness, you know, sometimes after about 2 hours, I think enough already, right? And then there's another big scene. And so one reason I love Reservoir Dogs is it's relatively tight by Quentin Tarantino's standards, but it's got all the elements there in terms of, you know, the emphasis is on character more than on action per se, more than on story per se. And it's got a great roster of characters. But let me set the stage for that. This being his first film, Reservoir Dogs, his friend, the producer, Lawrence Bender, really sets this in motion. He has Quentin's script. And Tarantino originally is thought of primarily as a screenwriter. In these early years, when he's making his first films, he's also writing screenplays for other directors, which we can mention briefly as we go along. But anyway, Lawrence Bender, who's worked with him a lot, sends the script to Harvey Keitel. This is how it works, right? And Harvey Keitel has a lot of clout, and he starts to pull the package together. One of the people pulled into it is the executive producer, Monty Hellman. Now, that may not be a household name, but in Quentin Tarantino's circles, it is a household name. It's a video store name. Monty Hellman directed a sort of near legendary film called Tulane Blacktop. Let's take an action film down to its basics. Just people on the road chasing each other. And, you know, there's not a lot of story otherwise, but you know what? It's kinetic. It's visceral. It's all those things Tarantino loves. Monty Hellman originally was slated to direct Reservoir Dogs. And he went to meet Quentin, who was still living with his mother at that point, and then felt, you know what, he should direct it. And he did direct it on a budget of $1.5 million. So really low budget film. Now, in terms of how it really sets the stage for his career, I mean, it's all about a robbery, a criminal heist, the colorful characters who do it, literally colorful, they're named for colors, Mr. Blue and Mr. White and so on. Already you get the template of, you know, violent action, but also the fact that it's really more character driven. There is violence, some of it really extreme, but other scenes, it's just people talking extreme violence, not actually necessarily doing it in the moment. In terms of how he knew it would set his reputation, he said, I don't want to be known as the guy with the gun because I like all kinds of movies, but I really like rowdy, rude stuff. So it sort of sets the tone that way. Now, I think the most significant aspect of it in terms of what was the filmmaking zeitgeist, to use that word for the last time in this episode, what was that like at the time? He, of course, was part of the independent cinema. This is a low-budget independent film. Bear in mind, his name would mean nothing to the general public at this point, right? Though he has name actors in it. And he knew his opening was here, his opportunity. Think about the kinds of movies that won awards at the Sundance Film Festival, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, things like that, and then to get broad commercial distribution. They could be bold with their sexuality, but for the most part, they didn't have a lot of violence because, you know, a good liberal conscience, you know, is not going to enjoy or knows it shouldn't enjoy violence on screen. But sex, yeah, you can enjoy that. But violence, no, you should not enjoy that. And I'm being very reductive with this, but I think the point is sound. And here's what Quentin Tarantino said, looking back on, and he knew at the time, this is what he wanted to do to make a name for himself. Here's Quentin. Independent cinema had sex at the time, but not as much violence. So it was a game changer. And that's really where he saw the opening there. Now, in terms of the violence in the film, again, so much of it is verbal, but there are several scenes in the film that are incredibly graphic, really disturbing. But again, in terms of how it's primarily character driven, and also in terms of how Tarantino already is playing games with time, he loves to have flashbacks, flash forwards, flash this and that. He loves to scramble that. In fact, he said once in an interview, stories do not have to be told in a linear fashion. And his best known films actually are notable for that. But again, in terms of the colorful characters, and they really are strikingly, you can see why actors love to work with them. They get a long leash. You can do a lot. And also the fact that this is great material to work with. And the dialogue, a lot of it is just like, you know, shooting the breeze, passing the time, nonsense dialogue, but it's memorably written. It's really sharp. But you have characters like Mr. White, Mr. Orange, Mr. Pink, Blonde, Blue, Brown. And then you get riffs on that, like, well, you know, well, why do I have to be Mr. Pink? That's Steve Buscemi. Why, you know, why can't somebody else be Mr. Pink? They're going to tease me about being Mr. Pink. But the actors he works with, we've mentioned Harvey Keitel, who in some way sort of sparked the project, Tim Roth, Chris Penn, Steve Buscemi, Michael Madsen, Eddie Bunker, Lawrence Tierney, going back to an old timer. And I have met Lawrence Tierney, but he was going back to Dillinger in the 40s. He was in tough guy movies. He was in B movies and he was still around. And see, Quentin knows that and he knows how to reach a guy. And a guy like that at that age, at that point in time, is not getting many job offers. So you can imagine your phone rings, you're sitting quietly there in semi-retirement and it's, you know, Quentin Tarantino be in my movie. And he's a great tough guy. So he'll do that. He'll have those plants, if you will, have some old time actor pop up that way. And Tarantino himself plays Mr. Brown. So again, he oftentimes will play roles in his own films. But watching the film is such a pleasure. It's just fun to watch these actors vamp and camp with each other. There's a performative aspect to Tarantino's work. In other words, it's not that the actors are breaking the fourth wall per se, but they are giving showy performances. Now tell me, you know, is there an actor who doesn't enjoy giving a showy performance sometimes? Just letting it all loose, right? And that's why, you know, with Tarantino, he just gets them in the moment and you can see them smiling at each other as they trade lines. They're having fun, and so are we.
You know, in terms of Reservoir Dogs, I really like this quote from Tarantino. He says, "This movie was never meant to be everything for everybody. And I don't mean that as a slam. I'm just saying I made this movie for myself and everyone else is invited. And I'm saying that because I have to say, I'm going to have to be the contrarian and say Reservoir Dogs is my least favorite Quentin Tarantino movie because I could not engage with all of the violence in it. And I didn't get the whole Quentin Tarantino thing the first time I saw it. And even going back watching it again, although I could appreciate a lot of the elements that make it unique and wonderful, and acting's fabulous, characters are terrific. And I don't think anybody actually can touch Quentin Tarantino in terms of writing. He's an incredible screenwriter, but it's just missing an element for me. Now, he counts Terry Gilliam as a major mentor, even according him a special thanks credit in Reservoir Dogs, which of course, again, makes me feel like I have missed something key about that movie because Terry Gilliam is just so incredibly innovative, you know, part of Monty Python, just a really interesting mind. I guess when I think about Reservoir Dogs, and I know you're going to disagree with me, it's like heresy, but I think a better movie in that thread was The Usual Suspects. By the way, he has said he wants to adapt Reservoir Dogs and The Hateful Eight as theatrical live performances, which I literally cannot see at all. Mike, can you? I don't want to spend too much time talking on this because he's got so many other movies to mention, but I just want to set this up for you by asking you the question. Every semester, we get new students and they always, always like Quentin Tarantino. Always. I mean, there's always people who've just discovered Quentin Tarantino. They can't believe how witty he is and how outrageous he is. And I think what you said about the rowdy, rude stuff kind of gets to the heart of what's appealing about him. But how do you account for his evergreen, you know, way of bringing in new film enthusiasts in a way that I would say Martin Scorsese does not do? As much as I love Martin Scorsese, I think Quentin Tarantino seems to be more visceral. He gets new fans all the time.
Well, I would call it a draw in terms of Scorsese versus Tarantino. And this is speaking as an academic, not just with the Hollywood in the 1990s course I referenced earlier, but in our introductory film courses, we watch films by Tarantino, like Django Unchained, by Scorsese, like The Departed, and not to get down in the weeds with particular courses and films, but my students often have a lot of flexibility as to what they're writing about. And some of them, you're right, they love to write about Quentin Tarantino and talk about him, but they also, like with The Departed, they really enjoy writing about that and in many cases know his work really well. So I would give them an equal credit there. Push come to shove, if we're playing percentages, Marie, I would agree with you that Tarantino, you know, might win by a few points, but we'll leave that as an academic discussion. But in terms of Reservoir Dogs, although, you know, watching it, I'm not thinking about Terry Gilliam as I watch it, as you mention it, and as the credits mention it, you're right. I can see a bit of a connection there. I wouldn't want to force it, but the thing about Tarantino's films, for all their violence, all the horrific stuff there, they're very funny. And one of the things he does in Reservoir Dogs, which becomes a trademark, is there'll be a really violent scene of torture. And I'm not even going to fill in the details here because it gets kind of gory, but it'll be like a really gross scene. But then it'll have some vintage pop tune playing on top of it, which has to make you smile. Just the disjunction there of you know, horrible action, but light and peppy pop song. Of course, Scorsese does something similar in a lot of his films too. We could write a thesis about connections between these two filmmakers. I have to point out, though, very quickly, that even though now we tend to talk about Reservoir Dogs as this kind of almost legendary or mythic send-off, you know, the career's launched, it's got to be said that when the film was initially released, it did not have particularly great reviews. I mean, like mainstream press, New York Times type press, it did not really have, it had some great reviews, but some others with reservations or negative. People turned off by the violence and this and that. But more importantly, it did not do well at the box office. It's easy to lose track of that. It had a very low budget, so it wasn't a disaster, but it did not really do all that well. However, and I love to use this expression, the right people saw it. And I oftentimes say this about films I want to champion. I'll say, you know, it wasn't all that much when it was first released, but you know what? The right people saw it. And I'm not really being facetious at this point. In other words, whether it's a film critic or a scholar or other actors, directors, agents, casting directors, they saw it. They saw the potential this guy had, the talent he had already right out of the gate. And that's something that made it inevitable that, you know, within a couple of years, he's making his second film, Pulp Fiction, which is going to get a lot more by way of audience and recognition. And, you know, at that point, he's really cemented his reputation.
I think Pulp Fiction is the gateway drug into Quentin Tarantino's movies. That is the film that most of my students will mention as, you know, what they saw of his that just amazed them and, you know, took them down the road of watching all the things that he does. Now, Pulp Fiction is three stories about one story. And Tarantino says he's actually always thought of Pulp Fiction as a rock and roll spaghetti Western. And in answer to a film critic as to why his films were always extremely violent, because it's so much fun. Now, you have to love somebody who just puts it out there like, you know what? It really is fun. But having said that, and we don't have a lot of time to talk about Pulp Fiction, but we have to talk about it at least a little. Mike, I want to ask you how you think it fits in that his favorite, you know, movies growing up, Tarantino, I mean, were The Three Stooges. And one of his favorite films was Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. How does that dovetail into a movie like Pulp Fiction?
It dovetails perfectly. I know it seems counterintuitive to even say that. When I went back and read some of the original reviews of Pulp Fiction, and one of my favorite lines was in the review in Variety, the trade newspaper, where Variety referred to Pulp Fiction and to Tarantino, of course, as, quote, the Preston Sturges of crimeland. In other words, take some criminal story and do it in a way that's clever, funny, witty, just ha-ha funny. And yes, you can then work in Abbott and Costello if you want. You know, there's so much humor. There's so much comedy. Whether there should be or not is an ethical discussion that we could spend hours on, but it's there, right? They're fun to watch, as you say. Again, this is the film that really put him over. It won the Palme d'Or, the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival. He won the Academy Award for his screenplay, original screenplay. And, you know, and Murray, you know, talked about him as a writer. He got the Oscar there. He was also nominated for Best Director. And in terms of how well he works with actors, John Travolta, Samuel L. Jackson, Uma Thurman, Harvey Keitel, Tim Roth, Chris Walken, Bruce Willis, Ving Rhames, many of whom he'd work with again and again. It's almost like an ensemble company. He's really, you know, a terrific director, as I've been saying, in terms of working with actors. Now, I do admire Pulp Fiction. And again, it's a film that you have to watch a few times because talk about time scrambling. I mean, to the extent there's a story, it's jumping here, it's jumping there. And a lot of it just works as monologues. I mean, Chris Walken has a great monologue about a gold watch. Does that need to be in the film? Not really. It's just like the only moment in the film. But you know what? It's a great moment. And so even though I have, frankly, kind of mixed feelings about Pulp Fiction, I do admire it. I mean, there's so much going on there. There's so much terrific acting and so on. But again, and this is the hobby horse I keep riding in our episode today, is in terms of running time. It's 153 minutes. And for me, it's like, okay, the film works. I'm enjoying it. But, you know, Tarantino, is this a great revelation? He tends to be self-indulgent. You know, you have a lot of scenes that are there just because they're fun. And you get a lot of that, and it adds up to films that start to push the three-hour mark. And for me, really, from this point onward, from Pulp Fiction onward, I almost always enjoy his films, but sometimes I reach the sort of threshold moment of, okay, it's been 2 hours or 20 hours, you know, enough already. Let's bring it to a close. And so again, I've always had those mixed feelings about him, but push come to shove, sure, I admire him for his technical capability and certainly for his ability of working with actors and just for that film knowledge, that film history. As a film geek, how could one not like that? I mean, it's just so much fun to watch these films.
Well, we're not going to be able to talk about all of his films. We will mention, well, I want to definitely mention Inglourious Basterds because that is my favorite Quentin Tarantino movie. That is the movie that when I saw it, it was like, I finally get it. I get why he is so good. And part of it has to do with what you intimated, which is there's a lot of wit in with all the violence that he puts on the screen, which I think it says a lot about how clever he is. And he talks about the violence in his movies, and he says, yeah, sure, Kill Bill is a violent movie, which it is, but it's a Tarantino movie. You don't go to see Metallica and ask them to turn the music down. Now, he said that in a much more crude way, but, you know, the intent is there. You can see what he means. Now, in terms of the movie The Hateful Eight that he made, this was a big deal when he made it in terms of, you know, using the technology from the past, which is still the best, apparently, in terms of looking at a movie. And in order to see it that way, you had to go to the theater, and it was a special thing. And now people are watching The Hateful Eight on, you know, DVDs and whatnot. So between The Hateful Eight and Once Upon a Time in, wow, I don't think I got the name of that movie right at all. The
Upon Time, dot, dot, dot.
Yes, dot, dot, dot.
And there's a whole discussion about why the ellipses, but that would take, you know, 20 minutes to go into. But, you know, that was came out in 2019. And again, for my money, too long, 161 minutes. But you know what? I absolutely love the production design in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And it just, it evokes 1969 perfectly. It's a, such a joy to watch it, just in terms of the, you know, the signs, the movies, the costumes, everything. It's terrific fun that way. And the acting, as always, in Tarantino. Brad Pitt, Leonardo DiCaprio, great fun, great fun.
Now, in terms of Inglourious Basterds, one of the reasons I like that movie so much is because it's about, you know, there's a thread in there that's about movies. And that to me is what put it over the top. As I could just watch it again and again. I think it has so much wit. It does have a lot of violence in it. It's actually kind of hard to watch in parts, but it's so incredibly clever. I think that is the best screenplay he's actually written. I absolutely love that one. But I do think the most recent one, the Once Upon a Time, dot, 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 was really fun to watch because he captured everything you want to say about that time period, the cars and the clothes and the attitudes and where movies were and the whole way of incorporating the Manson murders and, you know, the one characters, Sharon Tate, you know, the excitement about being a movie star and finding your movie playing and going to see it. These little moments of movie history woven throughout an otherwise not about the movies kind of movie. I just thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, again, it's the evocation of the period. He's done his homework. He really knows the material, not just cinematic, but in a broader cultural sense. So, you know, to see actors portraying Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski and members of the Manson family, it's so believable. I mean, you really feel like you're in Los Angeles in 1969. It's really amazing. I mean, how well he does that. I wish he, you know, had a tighter sense of timing and of just, you know, pacing and all that. But you know what? What would I cut? I mean, so many of the scenes are so enjoyable. It would be a challenge as to what you would take out of it.
Now, he said in a radio interview that the one thing he cannot stand seeing in movies is real animal and insect death or torture, and that real acts of violence have no place in film, which is about realism through artifice. But you might not know that by watching some of Quentin Tarantino's movies, because he really does lean heavily on those gore keys when he is writing his scripts. But, you know, that is apparently part of the man's genius, so we're just going to have to give it to him. And that wraps up our show. Don't forget to check out our other episodes on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com, and we will see you at the movies.
All right, see you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.